The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
So I think it was so dark in here, but I think most of you have been here most of the time. But just to remind you, this is a series, the fourth in a series called Imagining Prophets. Monday was Moses, Tuesday was Elijah, Wednesday was Amos, today is John the Baptist, and tomorrow is Jesus. As I was leaving yesterday, it occurred to me, with great shame maybe, that I may have been seriously skewing the variety of prophetic ministry. And someone had said to me, how come you haven't done Isaiah? And that reminded me of Isaiah's persistent theme. It must be why we use Isaiah so much in Advent. Isaiah's persistent theme that the prophetic task and God himself is engaged both in tearing down and building up. In Walter Brueggemann's book, which I've referred to, called The Prophetic Imagination, he describes that in this way, that one of the prophet's tasks, maybe the prophet's first task, and it's a nice phrase, to bring grief to public expression. So there is much to regret out there, and sometimes that comes through owning someone else's grief or declaring your solidarity with it and helping them give voice to it, actually an old community organizing principle. But the other prophetic task, the second prophetic task, is to imagine an alternative future. And in one of Brueggemann's chapters, he even suggests that if a church had to make a choice, not that it does, if a church had to make a choice between its imaginal task, that is to say, vividly imagining and portraying an alternative community and maybe social and economic system, or engaging in what we would call social action, marching, joining organizations, and so forth, he would pick the first, which is somewhat startling. You might have thought that everybody would think social action, social justice-centered ministry, would be the trump, the thing that you would most want to commit yourself to. But Brueggemann argues that a society, and of course he's writing as an American, a society is so entrenched in its own assumptions, its own worldview, its own comfort with a particular way of doing things, that the church would have a startling and radical ministry if it simply succeeded in projecting into the air, maybe through YouTube, who knows, projecting into the air God's alternative, what a different kind of social system would look like. So then, we'll come back to that. So then I thought to myself, now how come I haven't been so far, 3 out of 5, how come I haven't been doing this part? So then I had to talk with myself, and I'm going to ask you to have a talk with yourself in a moment. So I tried this test on myself. Let's say I go to a film festival, and there's one impossibly pretentious, self-important film that really annoys me, or annoys one, for relishing the very thing that violence, let's say, that it purports to be opposing or satirizing. And on the other hand, there's another film that I've also seen that is just extraordinary and wonderful. And my editor says, which film do you want to review? I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I know I would want to review the bad film. Because there's something, it could be, I suppose it's a defect in my personality, that I might prefer to do the critique job to the celebrative job. And over the years, I haven't done as much preaching as most clergy because I've mostly been living in a university. But over the years, I've sometimes asked myself, when you're writing a sermon, how come it's so much easier to do the law part than the gospel part? And for those of you who aren't Lutheran, Lutherans have, all Christians are committed, I presume, to these two tasks in their ministries. But in the Lutheran tradition, it's deeply embedded in the whole way that we think about theology. And every pastor who goes through a Lutheran seminary learns that she must know how to diagnose the evils in the social system and in the human heart and say something about them, condemn them, call to repentance, as well as proclaim the gospel. And I remember in St. Louis when I was in seminary, I was repeatedly warned, we were repeatedly warned by our homiletics professors that the temptation will be to spend all of your imaginative literary power doing the law part. This is how society and all you bozos fall short. And then add one sentence, throw the gospel in here. So when we did that, we'd get a D, you know, on our homiletics, our sample sermons. Because the assumption was, well, where's the imagination when it comes to applying the gospel? Oh yeah, John 3:16. But, you know, the real heart of the sermon is the bad stuff, because it's fun to write the bad stuff. So it could be that's not true of most of you, but I have discovered over the years that the bad stuff comes a little easier to me. I don't know, and so it's not quite enough to say, well, I had to concentrate on the prophet as a countercultural figure because of the prophets that I picked. Because when you pick Elijah, it's hard to identify the building up part. He's mostly a tear down prophet. Amos, if you look hard enough, there's build up stuff, but you could argue that what Amos is famous for is the big set pieces in Amos is the tear down part. But then how about Moses? I mean, after the tear down part with Pharaoh, Moses' whole prophetic ministry, you could almost call him an establishment figure. I mean, he ends up with, even if he didn't write them himself exactly, he ends up with the entire Pentateuch witnessing to the nation of Israel that he, under God, single-handedly created. Now, that's certainly a build-up ministry. And it's only with the bad guy, Pharaoh. Okay, and there's the little golden calf issue. And the whining in the wilderness. It's true, Moses calls the people out about the whining in the wilderness. When they say, you know, it was going to be this hard, we could have stayed in Egypt. Okay, so there is that. But overall, I mean, the overall legacy of Moses is, you could say, as an establishment figure, which suggests then that when we make statements about the prophetic role, it almost always needs to be more nuanced than we sometimes make it. But before we get to John the Baptist, let me ask you, it could be that you don't want to reveal the depths of your own personalities, as I just have. You know, I seem like a nice person, right? And I'd say mostly my students would put a happy face on me rather than a frowning face. But I know this about myself, that I take particularly delight in the tearing down part. But you might want to say something about your own instincts. You know, if we wake you up in the middle of the night, do you tear down or build up? You know, what's your first impulse? So you could talk about that for a second. Or a somewhat more distanced, safe discussion. Think of American Christianity at this moment, at the beginning of the third millennium, and say, which task is most urgent for the American church? Is it the tear down, the bringing grief to public expression task, or is it the build up imagining a new society? So, what do you think?
Build up.
Say again.
Build up.
Oh, okay, so say more than that.
Well, tearing down is kind of a, you know, you don't really get involved in tearing down. Kind of sit on the sidelines and shoot barbs across, but building up requires you get in there and actually do something.
Oh, okay. Okay. So maybe tearing down is too easy, you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's not constructive.
I think building up or imagining something that's not there yet is always more difficult. You have to somehow put things together that aren't there. And even if you have foundations or building blocks, you still have to construct things with some imagination, with some design sense, or envision it. And
okay.
That's hard work.
Okay.
I think that's really hard work. I think
okay.
It's always easier to edit someone's work.
Okay.
In terms of tearing it down and picking at it or knitting.
Okay. Yeah.
Don, I come from a part of the country that's immersed in church growth movements and mega churches. So I certainly understand the viewpoint of my members here, but I can't get into building up. I mean, the very notion of build in contemporary church is awesome to me because I can't imagine it apart from buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the church needs one more building.
Okay.
Since we're going to do a little exploratory psychology, I think there's two realities underlying this. One is that even if you wanted to tear down and change.
Can we hear him?
If you wanted to tear down and change, if you really want to do it, people are conservative. We don't throw away something when we don't know what the alternative is. If you can show the alternative, then and our conservatives, we will risk letting go of
okay.
that terrible thing we knew. And the other part about it, though, is that the temptation or the danger psychologically in fighting is that we become like what you fight against. So that whole notion of, you know, the city on the hill, build that and the rest will fall away. Don't spend your time trying to destroy those other fortresses, you just be into war.
Okay. Yeah.
The poet William Stafford taught writing for years, and he gave the class an exercise: write about somebody you like, and the page was practically blank. Then he said, write about someone you don't like, and they could fill, you know, pages. So I wonder if maybe
so they're sure. Like me.
I just don't have the language to even talk about it.
I would look at it. In a sense of tearing down old ideas of how church is ran and making new ideas of how church is run and go in new roads and new territories because like the other woman that's here, here in the States, we are a very multicultural country now, and looking at from a Native point of view is that the church has to really gain in how their spiritual growth is going in reaching out to people. And on the build-up part, is where they would be able to reach out in a better way.
Well, I think just partly in this country, in America, if you're talking about churches, I'm not sure, in the country, America tends to have, you know, this word number one, very kind of cocky self-righteousness, and anytime you're in that context, that is something maybe that it calls for tearing down, you know, it's
okay.
Just, I'm talking more about the
sense of ourselves, that that's something that just over here needs to be torn down, probably. And I'm not sure you have to have, yes, people want to imagine something, they want to see something else before they change. But I don't know that you have to have that. Sometimes if you're in something, you just know you're going the wrong way, you have to stop, even if you don't know what's coming next. And, you know, it's kind of risky. But you can do the tearing down without having something right ready there to, you know, replace it.
Yeah.
I think Obama's success with kind of review the idea that tearing down our structures politically works, as well as building at least a vision of the city on the hill, which is what I think he did, and bringing some of the number one people away from some of that into something else. So I love the idea of some of the things that were initially said here, of envisioning something so positive to draw the culture in that direction.
This is such an interesting course. Have you thought about writing a book on the a new approach to the prophets?
Well, a Hebrew Bible is not my area of specialty, so I'd be way far adrift there. I suppose I could do it as a social ethicist. Yeah. So I mean, the room is, over. Yeah, please.
Well, take a hypothesis that you really need both. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happens in the church, though, it's probably human nature, is if I put my energy into tear down, I'm classified as a tear downer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. If I go with group two, I'm classified as an imaginer, a builder upper. Mm-hmm. And there's a natural tendency in our nature, I think, to think that there's some more shortcomings in the other groups.
You'll certainly get invited to more parties if you're the build up personality. John the Baptist, Elijah, Amos, no, they will not get invited to parties. And they, but, so it's interesting. It could be that this is just the positive dimensions of the American character, or the fact that we're all ready to move ahead. And that's why this is slightly surprises me, frankly, but we're all ready to sort of come down on the build up, the new creation, the imagining new futures. One could even say the utopian, except in Lutheran theology we never talk about utopias, which invariably turn up as dystopias. But if you think of these as two essential tools, or the old doctor's bag thing. Or sometimes talk about the theological armamentarium. So you present yourself in the doctor's office, and he's got, or she's got, two kinds of medicine. One is the negative medicine that destroys your cancer cells or your infection or whatever. Because surely we'd have to say penicillin is a tear-down drug, I think. It destroys these things that are afflicting you. And then there's these other kinds of medicines, you know, they give you more red blood cells or something, you know, a transfusion, okay, if you got leukemia. So the doctor's got, the hospital, the healthcare system has two kinds of medicines or healthcare prescriptions. The removal of the rot, the enemy forces, the hostile cells that are taking over your body, those, or new red blood cells, more oxygen, whatever. If you say it that way, maybe you all wouldn't buy that analogy. If you say it that way, you might be willing to admit that these two are equally appropriate and necessary strategies. And then the imaginative task, the challenge, is to figure out which kind of medicine the patient needs. And someone in the back said, if you're going down the wrong road, so you may know the word repent in Hebrew, shuv, means turn around and go the other way. Okay. So if you're going down, some people said this about the war in Iraq. that no matter how much really clever advice you have, if you're actually heading the wrong way, the advice isn't actually going to help. Because the first thing you need to do is stop the Jeep, turn it around, and go back the other way. And then you can think about alternative methods. I mean, if you bought that analysis. So if you're going down the wrong way, and you, the prophetic voice, meet me on the wrong way and come up with a lot of good ideas, will they do any good if you can't get me to turn around? Because am I not just going to keep walking in the same wrong way? So now let me nuance it even more, and then it's not that I'm waiting for you to give me the answer I'm looking for. Okay, I know it's starting to sound that way. But let me nuance it even a little further. So you are now the chaplain to the United States, okay? Using chaplain in a neutral sense, not a lackey on the payroll, but a chaplain in a neutral sense. You're the chaplain to the United States. You read the literature, you check the New York Times for, 1 week straight or something, and listen to cable news and the bloggers and everything else. And so now you have to reach a decision. Before I come up with my speech, is the country fundamentally on the right track and going in a good direction? And do they need a boost, encouragement? Or is the country fundamentally in root and branch on the wrong track? And they're going to need some major rhetorical disruption that dislodges them from their firmly wrong convictions and frees them up to think new thoughts. Okay? I think you could look at the Old Testament prophets and the ministry of Jesus, actually, tomorrow, in that way. Is it this, or is it this? So if you pose it that way, and you're the chaplain of the United States, which one are you going with?
Well, I see us as at a really unique place in our country right now. I think we're at a teardown point that has made us question so many elements that we've taken for granted, whether it's our health and safety, our relationships with the world, our economy, our consumerist culture. And so we're kind of at a tear down point. And I think now's the time to build up again. So I would say that this would be a time for the chaplain maybe to not rant, but to try to encourage people of spirit, and I don't just mean Christians, but people of spirit. There's a void right now where the spirit can come in, and that can be harnessed. That's how I see it.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
I don't think it's so black and white either. I think, we as a nation, I feel we're somewhat confused. We don't have the role models that we'd like to have that would allow us to follow the imagined side. On the other hand, I think the chaplains really do have a golden opportunity because, in my view, one of our biggest problems is a lack of communication, especially between, shall we say, our seniors and the young adults. And the chaplains probably are in a position to promote that kind of dialogue.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, as far as the health care, the big issue this month, and I'd say I look at it as the chaplain say that I think we're on the wrong track, and all this fighting and I think you have to pose the imagination as a way to unite people and say, what do we really want as a society? Just leave all these different factions out. What do we care about each other as a society? What do we want in terms of health for our neighbor? And just kind of pose that as a question to everybody instead of all the different lies and myths and things like that.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, not as a chaplain, but just to finish off that Obama example there, in that he, yes, offered something different, but it was only after a whole huge amount of tearing down of the Bush administration, in America under that administration where he felt it had gone wrong and using all those things. And what he offered different was a little vague.
Okay. Yeah.
I think we have kind of a problem that the military always has. We've got great solutions for the last war, or the last problem, set of problems in the last generation. We've got to get something new now for the future.
By the way, I wore my T-shirt today. On the front it says love. On the back it says hate. So you really, I need to take this one out so you can actually see that I'm a dual kind of guy. a dialectical person. Yeah.
I wouldn't say that we all are on the same path, just using Obama as an example of this. I think with change, if you think about the, we're reading a book about Lincoln and slavery, and I think for huge change to happen, as we all know, is going to take many, many years. And at this point, I think with the healthcare system as it is, now there's this huge lash again, a negative response. And I think with anything that a person with a good imagination or a new idea comes up with, you're going to get this huge negative response if it's much different than the way that we have always done it.
Okay.
And I think that that's when your resistance is going to be thickest, and it's only going to build up. And where the other side, whoever the other side is, they will come out and they will squelch it and twist it and turn it and spin it however they want to do it, because by God, I want it the way that it's always been. I don't want change, and if you happen to be a large corporation, hell no. We want it the way that it has been. This is working for us. What you all don't understand, you know, we don't want you to understand. We like spin. It helps us. It benefits us. So I think that as healthcare gets heated up, it could be, and I may be over-exaggerating, but it could be like the 50s and the 60s. You know, again, somebody's got to have a big, nasty voice that says, my neighbor doesn't have any health care. There is nothing for my neighbor, especially my senior citizen neighbor here, my mother, his parents, etc. There is not the support that they need. And by God, I'm sitting on the cusp of this because I'm a baby boomer hitting 60 pretty soon. So, you know, and I wasn't a yuppie. So I think that there's an opportunity for, yes, we have to meet, we have to try to find a way to communicate with other people. But if you've got your mind set, and there's so much of the United States doesn't want to change their mind about anything, and they're going to put up a great deal of resistance.
Okay, did you hear an angry prophetic voice here? And notice when she mentioned both her parents-in-law and the neighbor next door, this is what Brigham means, bringing grief to public expression. Maybe she herself has a fine health care plan, but she's feeling solidarity with her in-laws and the neighbor and saying, I must raise my voice for them. I think I read his biography or his syllabus that he's a both and guy. Did I read that about you rather than either or guy? And think of Ezekiel. Ezekiel can look at the Valley of the Dry Bones and he hears the word of the Lord and imagines them coming to life. That's the prophetic imagination. But I mean, Ezekiel also has his crazy guy times.
I just want to say one more thing as far as Lincoln goes. We're reading the book, A Team of Rivals.
and it goes into each, and it's by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and it's just a wonderful book. And I found in the beginning of the book, just to say some of how maybe we might approach somebody else, that Obama, in some respects, is doing what Lincoln did do. He made he understood and he respected the differences, but he found a way, which I thought was quite smart, to incorporate into his cabinet and into other places some of his rivals, you know, and somehow or other, and he met them on a ground that was neutral. There was a certain amount of decorum and respect during those days, but still he had, you know, he said things in creative stories, et cetera, et cetera. But he kind of enfolded them, and then they learned that he wasn't such an evil, awful, terrible, threatening person, you know, but that there were similarities. There was something that we could, you know, somehow or other, there has to be this, I don't know if it is John the Baptist or something, I don't know, he was a little hostile. But anyway, some voice, although okay. I don't think we can be so blind as to think that there's not going to okay. be a huge struggle.
I've been thinking about your t-shirt. I think my t-shirt would have hope on the front and fear on the back.
Okay. So here's my hate. And here's my love. Yeah, so hope on the front and...
The hope and fear, okay. I think, are the two motivators that can be used on both sides. And it's easy to look at build up as an always positive thing. But that's not necessarily the case. When Bush okay. was president, we were attacked. We went through 9/11, which was a profound trauma for the nation. And we were motivated by fear, but we proceeded to build. We built up walls. We conceived a plan to build a wall between the United States and Mexico, a very big, tall one. We built this incredible routine that every citizen goes through before they board an airplane. There are a number of things that we built up. And as long as the fear is in place, tearing those structures down is going to be extremely difficult.
Okay.
And so you have to think about the two motivators on either side.
Okay. So let me just make a couple remarks about where we've been so far, because then we need to actually get to John the Baptist. So the good news is if someone in the room feels that they're definitely one or the other, is that in the larger vision, we're probably talking about both and. So there's a place. It could be that some of us, capable of swinging both ways, that's probably not a good metaphor, but going both ways. It could be that's fine, because the times will always call or allow for two different modalities of ministry or prophecy. But it seems to me, I would want to argue, that not everybody's capable of being really good or experiencing a powerfully existential call from God to do both of them. So surely in the modern church, there must be room for people whose deepest instinct is that we are on the wrong path, and God has raised me up, and don't think I like it, and it's no fun, and everybody hates me. But somebody has to raise their voice and say this. And there must be other people who just couldn't bring off that role. Not because their popularity needs are too great. I mean, that could be true also. But maybe not for that reason. But just because that's not the way they're put together. So surely the church will want to seek out in its clergy and its laity both roles, both messages, both kinds of people if it wants to be biblical. As we'll see tomorrow in the ministry of Jesus, depending on who he's talking to. You know, we're back to the doctor. What patient are you looking at? This one or the one with the next hour appointment? So in Jesus' ministry, which we mostly think somewhat lightheartedly, you know, mostly, you know, really, really mellow guy, but there are those angry denunciations of people who cling to embedded traditions that keep them from changing and repenting. With those people, Jesus is vigorously condemning, even if those aren't his best lines or his most consistent lines or the ones we remember the most. Okay, would someone open to Luke 3, 3 to 20? And whoever gets there first and feels like reading, please do so. The John the Baptist story appears in all the Gospels, but the most number of points just happen to,
He went into all the region around the Jordan, proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins, as it is written in the book of the words of the prophet Isaiah, the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight. Every valley shall be filled, every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough ways made smooth, and all the flesh shall see the salvation of God. John said to the crowd that came out to be baptized by him, you brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bear fruits worthy of repentance. Do not begin to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our ancestor. For I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children to Abraham. Even now the axe is lying at the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire.
Okay, is that verse 20? Okay.
10. Keep going?
Yeah, keep going till 20.
And the crowds asked him, what then shall we do? In reply, he said to them, whoever has two coats must share with anyone who has none, and whoever has food must do likewise. Even tax collectors came to be baptized, and they asked him, teacher, what shall we do? He said to them, collect no more than the amount prescribed for you. Soldiers also asked of him, and we, what shall we do? He said to them, do not extort money from anyone by threats or false accusations, and be satisfied with your wages. As the people were filled with expectation, and all were questioning in their hearts concerning John, whether he might be the Messiah, John answered all of them by saying, I baptize you with water, but one who is more powerful than I is coming. I am not worthy to untie the thongs of his sandals. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. His winnowing fork is in his hand to clear the threshing floor and to gather the wheat into his granary. But the chaff he will burn with unquenchable fire. So with many other exhortations, he proclaimed the good news to the people. But Herod the ruler, who had been rebuked by him because of Herodias, his brother's wife, and because of all the evil things that Herod had done, added to them by shutting up John in prison.
So really, you hear, I mean, presumably this is a condensation, okay? Luke is taking a number of circulating Baptist stories in the oral tradition, 70 or 80 AD, and he's putting them into this one pericope. And really, our entire previous 20-minute discussion, it's all in there. So on the one hand, brood of vipers, you know, he looks out at his potential congregation. I'll come back to that because it's kind of an irresistible line. But also, you can hardly hear Isaiah quoted without singing along, you know, with Handel's Messiah. But Isaiah's lines, every valley and we're going to make straight the way. And into the messianic age, I mean, a message of tremendous hope, if also you're not exactly on the right track now. And then even some kind of just little pithy advice, if you're a soldier in an occupying power, don't take advantage of your position. We've all experienced that with border guards in occasional parts of our life, maybe. So it's all there, though we might think of John in terms of iconography more, because he ends up with his head on a platter, more as the angry prophet who will not compromise and suit his message to Herod's needs. And so Herod's stepdaughter listens to her mother, who has been directly condemned by John the Baptist, and asks for his head on a platter. But while thinking about John the Baptist, I was just imagining, I've mentioned a couple of times that for a while, for PLTS, Pacific Lutheran in Berkeley, I was on the candidacy committee. And I was imagining, and sometimes you have there's a CPE guy here, clinical pastoral education, kind of sees whether people's heads are screwed on or there's serious signs of pathology there. So imagine you're on the candidacy committee and you're looking at the CPE report on the guy, and the person says, when I look out on a group of people, I tend to see a brood of vipers. Okay, that's it. He's not going to get a call, right? That's sort of like the MMPI. Do you sometimes feel like you're going to explode into fire? Okay, well, that's a good thing to know about you, and we're not going to give you a call. But there it is. It's kind of a prophetic thing. And also in the ministry of Jesus, although Jesus doesn't say brood of vipers, hypocrites, particularly to the religious establishment. So somebody must have a call to look out at the people who have just come in for the tent revival and say brood of vipers, because it's biblical. It's in the Old Testament. It's in John. It's in Jesus. But most people aren't signing up for that job. And if you're the bishop with this person coming into your diocese, and that's the leading method, tends to see broods of vipers, we aren't mostly, I think, ready for such a person. So maybe we could give him a call to
prison ministry.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because all the rest of us are really quite good people. So there must be somebody, or maybe send him to Cuba as a missionary. Or North Korea. To use the brood of, save the brood of vipers language for Iran and North Korea, and then the everything's gonna be really great message for Americans who deserve such a message. But what other things? Of course, you all know the John the Baptist story, and you knew it before you just heard it read. But what comes to mind? What do you feel? What images come to you, positive, negative, when you think of John the Baptist?
He does predict hope coming after.
Yeah. We'll come to this word open. So even somebody as big as Jerry Seinfeld, when he comes to an audience, he's coming to Seattle, I think, soon. When he comes to an audience, he often has an opener, warm the crowd up. And indeed, most big acts, the Beatles, everybody, has an opening act. And the opening is to sort of massage the crowd, get them into a good, if it's a comedian, get them into a laughing mood, so you're less likely to fall flat yourself. If they started out flat, let them fall flat on the opener rather than on the starring role. But if you expand a little bit on that open, it's like the big act is on its way, but I kind of want to till the ground, so when the big act arrives, you'll say, yeah, I could get into that, actually. I could consider that idea. And that's really his job in the as the last of the Old Testament style prophets to prepare for the ministry of Jesus, the new Exodus, really, the new creation that comes in, as Paul sees it, that comes in Jesus. So that could be also a task for the church, to be an opener for a much more expansive view of what God could do on the earth. Please.
So in the wintertime, there was a coffee house here at Holden Village, and the opening act was actually an extreme metal band. And they used texts from Revelation, and they were a bunch of teens, and they were quite good. And then there was some of the more traditional Christian camp songs that came afterwards.
Hmm.
I thought of that.
Yeah.
Well, not to divinize Obama, but you have Jeremiah Wright as John Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
You have Obama.
Yeah. I mean, when Obama went to Chicago, community organizers tend to be tough guys. Those of you who were in David's talk yesterday afternoon, I thought about the fact that when community organizers, not Obama in particular, but when community organizers got to Chicago, Mayor Daley, who was, as liberals go, sort of liberal, said, well, why would we listen to the poor people? If you were so smart, you wouldn't be poor. So it's going to have to be the Chicago machine that figures out what you need. But community organizers weren't having any of it. They said, their great Olinskian principle was organize around your own oppression or bring grief to public expression, all that kind of stuff. So no, Mayor Daley doesn't call the shots. Tell me your pain. These people, I guess that's the Bill Clinton line, isn't it? These people need to do that, and then you can sort of own what your dilemma is and what good news might sound like if you heard it. What else about John the Baptist?
Could you say a little bit about his bio? I have this kind of image of him through art as this wilderness guy wearing...
Yeah. Skins. Yeah. He's the sort of rough clothes and eats locusts and wild honey.
Lives
off the land. And... it was very common. Jesus also begins his public ministry. He doesn't end it there, and it's not where it mostly happens, but he begins his public ministry, and this is kind of an iconic notion also showing up in Western art. You begin it in the wilderness. And the Qumran community, Dead Sea Scrolls and all that, the Qumran community that John the Baptist could have been a part of, or at least was simpatico with, there was this apocalyptic tradition in ancient Israel that when God was ready to do a new thing, you couldn't do a new thing in the city. I mean, that's back to tear down first, build up later. And the city, as you were saying, the city's not going to hear it. So you're going to have to meet God in the desert. It's almost become a cliche. Like and that's where people go on retreats, right? If you want to meet God away from received assumptions, it's going to have to be in the desert. Because... the city, urban areas are too entrenched. So
it just made me a lot happier about both Iraq and Afghanistan. Thank you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess that's what we were seeking there when we went to the Middle East. So John the Baptist is this lonely voice who goes to the desert. And Martin Luther King, in his writings, talks about his desert experiences. It's where the prophet gets prepared, and it's where people who are willing to consider radical alternatives go to hear the voice of God.
There's also a little dynamic of nothing left to lose, because the thing that's stunning about this guy is that he puts all his chips on the table, and he has faith in something he hasn't even seen the glimmering of. And now, how are we, who have things to lose, to do this out of faith?
And you know, Herod is impressed, just as Pilate is with Jesus. As we might be today, a guy who has nothing to lose and takes tremendous risks and is clearly heading for his own destruction. So in Oscar Wilde's play, Salome, when I was a boy, we always said Salome, but I sort of learned to say that educated people now seem to say Salome. Or the opera with Wilde's text, Salome. John the Baptist... John the Baptist, Herod's stepdaughter is fascinated, sexually even, has this strange fascination. He's a powerful, swarthy, fearless, not a typical lackey at the king's court, but this fearless man, full of power and certainty and risk-taking. I mean, he's irresistible. And in Oscar Wilde's play and in the opera, she wants him to kiss her. And, of course, he's like, a monastic ascetic, or Joseph in Egypt. How could I do this thing and sin against God? So John the Baptist is not really tempted, by to kiss Salome, but that makes him all the more irresistible. What is it about women? Why do women want to be kissed by the guys that hate them? I don't know. But it's wonderfully dramatic. And maybe today, too, if we actually run into somebody like this, even if we don't agree, they're mesmerizing. Wow, who knew there were? Now, if we find out they're simply a professor on tenure, then the admiration goes down a little bit. Like, yeah, how powerful your prophetic voice is because the university is paying your bills. Okay, but if he's not on tenure, if he's a freeway flyer running from community college to community, I'm going to talk about my own world, community college to community college, taking tremendous risks, getting fired by one dean after another because he doesn't fit, but yet fearless and really able to tell the truth, as we want poets to do, to tell the truth and do it wonderfully. So he's... I think Western art too, and maybe just as we've been growing up with the John the Baptist story, we're sort of glad Jesus follows, you know, because there was more to say than John said, but boy, did he say it.
I don't think there's anything in the Bible about this, but I my own kind of imagination goes to the Jesus and John the Baptist obviously knew each other. They were supposed to be cousins. Did they grow up together? Did they share stories? Did they share ideas?
Yeah.
And when Jesus came to be baptized.
Yeah, it's all tantalizing. We really don't. I mean, Luke sort of implies, well, their moms knew each other, Elizabeth and Mary, but we don't really have, we just have to guess, I guess.
If your suggestion that he might have lived with the Essenes at Qumran.
Yeah.
Where there's been speculation, I guess, that maybe even Jesus did.
Yeah.
The thing about John that we don't hear in the gospel is he might have been a very literate, sophisticated, learned person in all this history, which our house radical is Bishop Spong, who's writing stuff like that. And boy, if the fundamentalists try to debate with him on biblical texts, they better be careful, because he knows it. John, there may be a lot more to John that just didn't get into the text.
I was, when I was writing my dissertation on the Jesus movement in the early 70s, a placard that hippies like to, the Jesus movement people like to carry around was, "Turn or burn." And I remember once at Grace Cathedral, this magnificent Episcopal Cathedral that sits on the hill in San Francisco, and you know they're all liberal, and I think some of us thought impossibly self-congratulatory, and their famous Bishop Pike, and you know, they were the kind of thing that these Jesus movement people said God would like to spit you out of his mouth, you know? So it was quite disruptive when a group of people in kind of, you know, bathrobes practically, had these great, what do you call these things?
Placards.
You know, and walked up the aisle of Grace Cathedral in San Francisco carrying signs, "Turn or burn." That's John the Baptist's message. But, and I think Grace Cathedral maybe thought these people were just impossibly naive and out of place and not properly dressed. And surely, you know, they were a great urban cathedral, and Bishop Pike really wanted San Francisco to say, hey, maybe there's something to Christianity because Pike is so mellow and interesting and everything, and surely this isn't the way. The presence of... The presentation of self by Grace Cathedral in the city of San Francisco was not going to be "turn or burn," okay? And maybe that was right. Maybe the task of a great urban cathedral is never going to be "turn or burn," but somebody's task must be that if it's going to be biblical religion.
Remember what happened to Bishop Pike, though, in the end, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe his John the Baptist persona caught up with him. let's close in the last 4 minutes. You could be carrying this away with you as well. If you think of John the Baptist as an opener, if you think of yourself as an opener, a field tiller for new hybrid seeds, not from Monsanto, surely, but from the kingdom of heaven, about to be planted. And you imagine, this is the imaginal task, you imagine a new age, a new exodus, a new creation. You know, how does the church has to learn, has learned, again, this lies deep in the Lutheran tradition, don't ever think you are the new age. You are the preparers for the new age. Luther called that bringing in the kingdom, the apocalyptic frenzy, when you said, we're it, and then there's certainty, and pretty soon you're burning heretics at the stake because you're so right. Okay, so Luther had a deep sense of that you are never the new age arrived in the flesh. You are always a precursor, maybe a prototype on your best days. But how would the church, if this is its mission, how would the church go about playing this John the Baptist role that is opening for the new age, getting society, culture, country, the world, ready for it? I know it's an extremely big question, but yeah.
I would say by knowing its place within the larger body and playing the function that God wants for it, rather than assuming every corner of the body is the head. Mm.
Okay. See, it's no small thing if you figure out one thing, namely, what's my role? Or, communally, what's the church's role? It's not the only game. It's not the only role. It's not the only truth. Full of faults. Motley crew. But we at least are certain about one thing. There is some role we're called to. Or roles, maybe better. Roles. And let's make sure that all the roles, this would be another way of making the point. So let's say we're it. You know, we're the 70 that Jesus sends out. We represent all the people who are going to be the Christian community going out. Somebody has to say, now, are all the roles represented? Who's got the Turn or Burn banner? See, if there are no Turn or Burn banners, then this is not entirely a biblical mission. Even if there's only one out of 30. So are we represented here? Or are we all just country club chaplains? Okay, so what else? We just got 1 minute left, but please.
During Lent at St. Mark's, I think it was the diocese was supposed to read the book, The Great Emergence, by Phyllis Tickle. And in one short sentence, it's that every 500 years the church has a gigantic rummage sale and gets rid of what doesn't work and builds on the new. And this is really the tear down, build up. Yeah. And that we're going through that right now. And the things that some of the tear downs are not much to do with the church. It has to do with technology and how this global community we're in, and people. I think people saying, well, that this Episcopalian church doesn't mean anything to me because of whatever reasons.
Yeah.
And so. I don't know where I'm going with this, but the tear down build up is much more global than it is in the church.
So tomorrow is come to Jesus time. Not in that normal way. Meaning we'll get to Jesus, the final prophet, but also maybe the transfiguring prophet. And we'll actually look at a whole number of just not long texts, but just individual one or two verses that give us the multiple dimensions of Jesus' ministry. Okay, thanks for coming.
Thank you.